From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show today, we dig into the governor's State of the State speech. We'll talk with Governor Rick Snyder about his call to repair Michigan's roads.
We should have done something years ago if you really look at the condition of our roads, because I don't find any Michiganders really liking our roads today.
And we examine the economics and politics of the governor's plans.
A lot of the things that he asked for were things that he also wanted done in 2012 that didn't get done.
Plus, proof that Detroit automakers learned a tough lesson from their near-death experience 4 years ago.
Well, number one is to embrace reality and to recognize that you're not special and they're not different and they're not entitled, that they really have to do the blocking and tackling just like everybody else.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder took to the State House floor last night as he presented his third State of the State address. On today's show, we talked to the governor about the new initiatives he's pushing for and proposals from last year that he wants the legislature to continue working on. And then we get a Democratic response. We'll talk with the Democrats' leader in the House, State Representative Tim Grimmel. But first, we turn to the North American International Auto Show. Tomorrow night, thousands will don tuxedos and evening dresses for the charity preview, which parenthetically will raise something in the neighborhood of $3 million or so dollars to help children's charities in Southeast Michigan. Then Saturday morning, the show opens to the public. If you're headed to Cobo Center to check out the cars, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes believes you will also see something much deeper, proof that the U.S. car companies have truly undergone a resurrection and a rebirth from their near-death experience of just 4 years ago. Daniel Howes joins us now. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. Well, your column in today's Detroit News really made a great point that anyone who thought Detroit wasn't able to change really does need to come to the auto show. What have you seen from the car makers that had you so impressed?
Well, you know, I've been going to these shows probably since the mid-90s, and, you know, every time and every year you would see something from GM or Ford or Chrysler that was, you know, heralded as a great product. It was a great pickup truck. It was a great new Corvette or a Viper or a minivan or, you know, fill in the blank.
Sure.
But in almost every case, what was behind it were companies that had a very terrible financial situation. They were losing money, and they may be able to build a single good car or truck, but the fundamental business was pretty crappy.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at this situation, and you see that strong metal. You see a lot of strong entries in a lot of different segments, and underpinning them are companies that are making more money than any time they've made in a lot of cases, your listeners' lifetimes. It is evidence of a dramatic change in the business models of these companies, in the way they are managed, in the reality, in the real world that they're managing these companies in. You know, for a lot of years I used to refer to, you know, Detroit had its own economic laws, that somehow they were immune to the normal laws of supply and demand and profit and loss in the business world, and they acted that way. They certainly haven't been acting that way in the last few years, and I think that is a very refreshing change. And a lot of the other foreign manufacturers that are showing their products at the show have been pretty consistently profitable throughout this period. They've certainly were stressed at the in the 08, 09, and into 10 time frames.
Right.
But the Germans and the Japanese and the Koreans, they run their businesses, and they run them well as a general proposition, and they're competitive.
So what do you think the home team has learned from its near extinction?
Well, number one is to embrace reality and to recognize that you're not special and they're not different and they're not entitled, that they really have to do the blocking and tackling just like everybody else. And I think that may sound simple to a lot of people, but it really hasn't been in this town for a very, very long time. And you've now got these three companies are led by people who are not of Detroit. They don't owe anything to, they don't owe their advancement or their rise to the top to the bureaucracies of these three companies. They're not products of the cultures. They are products of the outside. And,
mm-hmm.
and the way they manage and the kind of people they promote and the people they put in jobs, and they all approach it very, very differently. Al Mulally at Ford pretty much has done what he's done in the last 6 or 7 years with Ford people.
Right.
I mean, you could count on one hand the number of top executives that were cashiered in Alan Mulally's 6.5 years at Ford. General Motors, very different, went through bankruptcy, very difficult. An entire cadre of leadership was pushed out. The CEO, of course, Rick Wagoner, was famously fired by an emissary of the President of the United States.
Sure.
And in the case of Chrysler, it was essentially given to Fiat of Italy. And it is now really the lion's share. It accounts for 60% of all the world volumes of the Fiat Chrysler group come out of Chrysler.
That's quite amazing.
Yeah, so Chrysler really is pulling the sled in that situation. So they're all very different, but I think if you listen to these guys and you watch the way they operate and you even look at the people, I mean, Ford Motor Company feels like a very different company than it did 6 or 7 years ago, and I've been around it and covering it in various parts of the world since the mid-90s. Very different company, but it's a lot of the same people. And, you know, I think it's a great story of American industrial regeneration and redemption.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist. His piece in today's Detroit News focusing on the progress made by the domestic car makers as evidenced in the 2013 North American International Auto Show. Dan, you note that the types of vehicles that are being trotted out this week and being shown off, you call that a refreshing return to the natural order of things. Take us into that.
Well, if you think back on the shows in 2009 and 2010 particularly, I thought that there was an awful lot of kowtowing to government bureaucrats and the Washington politicians. And there are good reasons for that.
Yes.
Because at the time you had $49.5 billion had been floated into General Motors to keep it alive. Billions more had been floated into Chrysler to keep it alive and keep it on life support. And there was kind of an expectation that if we're going to put our money into these kinds of companies, then you better be building the quote, right kind of products, as if a bunch of Washington politicians know what the right products are. And you saw that. You saw Speaker of the House at the time, Nancy Pelosi, here. You people following her around with her great entourages. You saw other people here. Now, I think if you go on the floor today, you're still going to see electric vehicles. You're going to see, in fact, it doesn't matter if it's General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, or it's BMW, Mercedes, Toyota, Lexus, but Nissan, Volkswagen. I mean, it's everybody's doing alternative fuel vehicles of some kind or another. But I think what the emphasis was in the show, particularly from Detroit, was the vehicles that people want to buy. You saw pickup truck wars starting up again.
Yes.
General Motors brought out its new full-size pickup. Ford countered with a concept of what they're calling the Atlas, which is the next generation F-150.
Mm-hmm.
Chrysler won Truck of the Year for its Ram pickup. GM showed its Corvette.
Reviving the Stingray name.
Talking about, certainly talking about fuel economy. I don't mean to suggest that everybody's back to gas guzzlers here.
Right. There's a new awareness.
But I think what the focus was on the segments and the kind of products that sell and the kind of products that make money and the kind of products that subsidize these alternative fuel vehicles, because almost all of them are loss leaders. You don't make money on them as a general proposition. And you had General Motors executives declaring, even as they launched or unveiled the Cadillac ELR, which is essentially the Cadillac Chevy Volt, that the electric car isn't dead. And why are they saying that? Because electric car, as a segment in 2012, was really gasping for air. It just really wasn't catching fire. Because the other part of the story here, Cynthia, is that all the manufacturers are making huge strides in the fuel efficiency of the traditional gasoline-powered engine.
Right.
And so a lot of people are looking at this and saying, you know, I can get a much better product and get a lot better fuel economy than the 5 or 6-year-old product I'm driving now and not pay the alternative vehicle premium for the powertrain, which is essentially what they are. And that's what I mean by the natural order of things. I mean, as there are customers that will adopt those new technologies, but as a general proposition, most people are more comfortable with the traditional technologies and knowing where they can get the gas and how it's going to operate. They are buying different kinds of vehicles, but nevertheless, that's kind of where we are.
So, Dan, in our last minute or so, what do you think that the 5,500 or so journalists who've been swarming all over Cobo, what are they taking away as a message about Detroit and its auto industry?
Clearly, I think they take away that is clearly relevant and that this is a global capital. And I think you could even argue in some ways it's the global capital, because if you go to Germany, and I was there, based there for 4 years, it's much more diffuse. The big three companies in Germany, Daimler, Volkswagen, and BMW, are in all three different cities in the country. They're not concentrated in, say, a Frankfurt or in a Stuttgart or something like that. So it's much more diffuse. And as a result, I think Detroit clearly is an epicenter, if you can't think of me more than one, but an epicenter of the industry. Secondly, I would say that, you know, particularly the Europeans who are going home, they're going home to a mess. The European industry is a mess. Way too much capacity, way too many employees. Demand is going through the floor. And the political culture in a lot of European countries militates against the companies really doing what they need to do. I think one of the things, if they're honest with themselves, they can look at this and they can say, Detroit really has got its act together, albeit with, in two cases, the assist from the U.S. Treasury. But there was something worth saving. And I think what you see on the floor today and in the next couple of weeks is that there was something worth saving.
Dan House, thank you so much for your insights.
My pleasure.
Daniel House is a business columnist for the Detroit News. Still to come, Governor Rick Snyder joins us to talk about his address last night to the state. Where does he see Michigan going in 2013? And we'll get some analysis of the speech, what it did and didn't set out to do. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder made his pitch for higher taxes and fees to pay for roads in his third State of the State address last night. Among many other new initiatives, the governor says Michigan needs at least $1 billion more in the next year to pay for badly needed repairs to the state's ailing infrastructure. The governor joins us now. And Governor Snyder, you're pushing the legislature to come up with ways to increase road funding. And you called for that also in a special message in October 2011. What's the thinking the legislature will now be able to get this done when they didn't in the last session?
Well, when I first put it out there, I wanted to really get people talking about the subject. And now it's time to put a specific proposal out there and get the bills introduced and move ahead and make it happen, because we've talked about it long enough. Actually, we should have done something years ago if you really look at the condition of our roads, because I don't find any Michiganders really liking our roads today. And they do need to be better. The good part about this process, this is all about saving money, too. We've done a careful analysis, and by actually doing this the right way, by this $1 billion a year, it will save us a tremendous amount of money that we'd otherwise have to pay later. Treating us more like we're a family, trying to figure out how we should invest our dollars than the old-fashioned political process that hasn't worked well. Because if you step back and look at it, roughly this $1 billion a year, if we did that for 10 years, it totals $10 billion. That's a lot of money. But if we didn't, we actually did the calculation to say the bill we would have to pay to bring our roads back to just to where we would have been if we would have done that $1 billion is $25 billion. So it's a huge savings by doing this, and it does other things. Actually, if you look at it, we pay more in vehicle repairs because of the conditions of our roads than our surrounding states by about $80 a year. So that $1 billion a year really equates to about $120 for the average vehicle, $10 a month. We could offset that. We'd have that $80 potentially savings available to help offset that. It'd bring in about 12,000 jobs more a year for all Michiganders and helping our economy, and it would save about 100 lives every single year that we made this $1 billion investment. You can't put a price on that. So when you add those things all up, I think there's a compelling case to say, let's get this done.
Well, then speaking of getting this done, it's definite that you would need Democratic support to increase funding and get this through. Do you expect you'll get it?
Well, I hope people, both parties, look at this and just say, isn't this common sense? Isn't this something that our citizens have been calling for, or better roads for a long time? And it shouldn't really be a partisan thing. It should be about legislators saying, hey, here's better service to our citizens, our customers, to make our state better.
Now, you talk, Governor, about the need for early childhood education funding. Republican Senator Roger Kahn is a big proponent of this. What should we expect to see with this possible effort?
Well, there are more kids that are eligible for a program, a Great Start program, to help them with early childhood, preschool. And we've got a number of kids in that program, but there's about 29,000 more kids that could be in that program if we had the resources. So I really want to look in the budget to say, how many of those kids can we get this year? And it may be a challenge to get them all this year. How much can we look forward in the future 2 or 3 years? So over the course of the next few years, let's get all these kids in that program because it shows it has value. It really helps the kids. We've been doing the same thing with a program called Healthy Kids Dental, about dental coverage for kids in need. And we've been rolling that out over the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm proud to say, well, we've added, this current budget year, about 90,000 more kids to the program. And I hope to do some more even this next budget year until, again, we're showing that for the Michiganders in need, because it's good things for those kids and it helps save us all money in the long term.
Governor, it certainly seemed like a theme of last night's address is pushing forward with measures that you still want to see get done that didn't in 2012, Blue Cross Blue Shield reform and the statewide education achievement authority and overhauling the state's no-fault auto insurance system. Does the fact that there's so much unfinished business from last year concern you? Does it keep you from moving forward with new, fresh initiatives?
I'm pleased with the progress we've made. I mean, if you look at it, we've accomplished a lot more than I think most people had expectations, and we've raised the bar on that. The thing is to keep pushing forward. I have a motto of relentless positive action, no blame, no credit. Keep pushing forward, solving common sense, using common sense to solve problems. And part of that is being relentless. So if you don't get something the first time, let's keep on pushing ahead until we get it done. And that great illustration are roads, a couple of the other things you mentioned. And again, it's about working together and making better products and more jobs for our people in their state.
You know, speaking last night, you talked about wanting to move on from the really controversial lame duck legislative session, which is very understandable on your part. And then a Democratic lawmaker responded that he thinks it's the equivalent of beating somebody up and turning around the next day and acting like you want to be best friends with them. Can you understand that reasoning and that frame of mind?
Well, they're sharing how they feel. The way I look at it is, it's not about beating anybody up. It's about better service to our citizens, our customer. And we have common customers. I have 10 million customers. Our legislators all have the people in their district. And we're all trying to help the state. So the focus should be not on where we disagree on policy, but it's always coming back to the focus of how do we do a better job of taking care of our customers, the citizens of Michigan, and showing them the best results and giving them good reasons to feel proud for why they hired us.
But can you understand that mentality, though?
Well, again, I appreciate it, but again, I hope people look beyond it and they shouldn't feel beat up. We had a difference of view and we moved ahead. So let's try to find common ground areas where we can solve problems together. And you mentioned it. Roads is a good illustration where we could work together on, and a number of these other initiatives, such as early childhood.
Governor, let's look ahead past 2013 to 2014. Now, of course, you haven't yet announced that you're planning on running for a second term in 2014, So I guess what I'm wondering, how much of what has happened with the struggles and those protests and the controversy, especially at the end of last year, how much would that weigh on your decision to run again in 2014?
I would say it's not a major factor because I'm just trying to do the best job I can. And I don't actually spend a lot of time thinking about reelection. I'm really focused in on here are some major issues that have faced Michigan for a long time. And here are opportunities to move our state forward. And I believe if you step up and try to do the right thing in good faith to best represent the people the best way you can, people will respect that. So I just come to work every day saying, again, how do we do the best job for more and better jobs and a future for kids?
Governor Rick Snyder, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
It was great to be with you. Take care.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside here on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's continue our look now at last night's State of the State Address, as we're joined now by State Representative Tim Grimmel, who's the Democratic leader in the State House. Welcome.
Thanks, Cindy. It's great to be on the show.
Good to have you, Representative. Obviously, we know you come from a different party than the governor, and we know there was so much that happened at the end of last year to cause bitterness amongst Democratic ranks. Our question is there anything that Rick Snyder talked about in last night's speech that you think you could work with him on?
He mentioned a few things that I think are potential areas where we could hopefully find common ground with the governor. One of them is his proposal to allow people to register to vote online instead of having to go to a clerk's office in person. We think that makes a lot of sense. In fact, we've been proposing that for years. I introduced a bill just last term to do that, and I believe that a Democratic senator introduced a bill to do that in the past couple of days. So that's something that Democrats have long been talking about, and we're excited to hear that the governor is interested in pursuing it. The other areas where I think there's a lot of promise to work together, he mentioned the need to invest more in making mental health care accessible and affordable. We think that's very important, especially in light of some of these tragic shootings that we've seen that might have been prevented had people had more access to health care. So certainly those are a couple areas. The other is early childhood education. That's another area that we have been talking about for a long time as Democrats. And, of course, we know that investing in quality early childhood education actually saves the state money in the long run because young people who receive that quality early childhood education are much less likely to end up on welfare or in prison, and much less likely to need remedial or special education in school.
Of course, the centerpiece, Representative, was the transportation issue and transportation funding. And it struck me, here you had a Republican governor standing in front of everybody talking about raising taxes as an investment, which for the future, which strikes me as something that should kind of warm Democrat hearts.
Well, you know, let's be clear. Democrats are not necessarily keen on raising taxes, especially when those taxes hit middle class and working families in our state. And that's actually been one of our big concerns with what the governor has done over the past 2 years, is that the governor, together with legislative Republicans, dramatically slashed taxes for big corporations in the state and paid for it through cuts to education and by raising taxes on middle class and working families. We think that's the wrong direction to go in, and we've been very concerned with the lack of tax fairness and equity under the governor's agenda the past 2 years. And if his proposal for funding roads is just more of the same, piling more financial burden on top of middle-class families in the state that are already overburdened, we have very, very serious concerns about that. Now, having said that, the governor was very light on details about exactly where this revenue is going to come from. Just as he was light on details on a number of other matters, including early childhood education and mental health care. So, you know, we are eagerly awaiting some more specific policy proposals from the governor. But we will be evaluating any road funding proposal based largely on this criterion of how does it impact middle-class families that are already struggling in a difficult economy and under large tax burdens that the Republican legislature and the governor imposed on them.
in fact, it seems that the governor kind of turfed it right back to the legislature, saying, I look to the legislature for the details on putting this together. And considering, you know, clearly sour feelings left over from lame duck, how likely is that to happen as far as a sense of cooperation and working together?
You know, the bottom line is that Democrats in the State House have always stood ready to work in a bipartisan way with the governor and with legislative Republicans. Last term, we repeatedly offered suggestions and proposed solutions. Unfortunately, the governor virtually never took us up on any of those suggestions, and he almost never reached out to us. And so we're certainly skeptical about whether the governor really has turned over a new leaf. The proof will be in the pudding. It's easy to pay lip service to bipartisanship, but are his actions actually going to back that up? But, you know, we stand ready and willing and eager to work together in a bipartisan way to move our state forward, and we'll have to see whether or not the Republicans show that same willingness. Certainly, the events of last December, where the governor, after saying for over 2 years that so-called right-to-work legislation was too extreme for our state, then did an about-face and became its champion and rammed it through in the waning days of the lame duck session, with the Republicans in the legislature suspending the normal rules to avoid committee hearings and to prevent the public from having an opportunity to be heard on the matter, gives us great pause in terms of our ability to trust the governor. But we're willing to try to stay open-minded and at least open up dialogue with the governor. But again, the past 2 years have not given us much reason to trust in the governor and trust in his rhetoric about bipartisanship.
Representative Grimmel, it's interesting, and it's been noted widely this morning that the three words right to work never made it into last night's speech. Was there anything Rick Snyder could have or should have said in last night's speech to help move things forward, to help heal?
It's one of those things that I don't know that there's anything that the governor could have said that would have made everything all right. Mm. You know, it was just weeks ago that he pushed this terrible policy that we know, based on the experience in other states, lowers wages and guts benefits for all workers, union and non-union employees. And it's a bad policy. It's bad economic policy. The governor's actions were pure politics. And that's unfortunate. It's also interesting, though, that the governor doesn't want to bring it up. In some ways, I think he's backing away from it because he's probably rightfully ashamed of what he did in December. But obviously, we're not dumb. The people of Michigan aren't dumb. We're not going to forget what happened just a few weeks ago. And the key question isn't about what the governor says or doesn't say. The key question is going to be, what does the governor actually do to demonstrate bipartisanship and to show for a change that he's actually concerned about middle-class families in the state?
Let me ask you this, Representative. Could you give us some sense of the Democratic agenda for 2013? Not necessarily just themes, but really, are there proposals or initiatives that we will see coming from your party?
No. Well, I think you will see a number of detailed proposals coming from our side of the aisle. We just announced 2 days ago that we will be embarking on a listening tour throughout the state to hear the specific concerns of Michigan residents from Menominee to Monroe. And we're going to want to hear, first of all, how the policies of the past 2 years have impacted families. We suspect that's mostly for the worse, but there may be some positives there, too, and we look forward to hearing both the positives and the negatives from folks. And then more importantly, we want to hear from Michigan residents what solutions they think will actually improve the quality of life for them and their families. And based on the feedback of that listening tour over the next couple of months, we will be developing some specific proposals. I can tell you right now that our caucus unanimously feels very strongly that we need to be investing more in education, that's the real key to our state's economic future, is investing in education at all levels, K through 12, certainly at the college and university level, and early childhood education. And while the governor has paid some lip service to education, He has dramatically cut funding for education at all levels. K through 12 schools have seen this governor and Republican legislature's policies cut hundreds of dollars per student from their budgets. We've seen dramatic and draconian cuts to university funding. We know that those policies are bad for Michigan, that they're compromising our economic future, and we need to see a reversal in those policies on the part of this governor and this legislature. So we're going to be fighting very hard for increased funding for our schools.
Representative Tim Grammel, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Meantime, some union leaders and workers say they will continue fighting the right-to-work legislation that was signed into law by Governor Snyder late last year. UAW Local 652 President Mike Green was among about 200 union workers who protested outside the Capitol last night. He said Snyder's silence on unions was, quote, just like he didn't pay attention to what people wanted in the first place. Green wouldn't discuss concrete steps the union will take to fight the legislation, but he says union workers, quote, are not going away. So what did you think of Governor Snyder's speech last night? Did you hear something you liked, hear something you didn't like, wished you'd heard something else? Let us know. We are online at michiganradio.org. You can click on the link that says Stateside. We're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still ahead on Stateside, we continue talking about the governor's State of the State address. And President Obama will, of course, be sworn into his second term on Monday. In 15 minutes, we'll have the story of one Michigan woman's journey to the president's first inauguration. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We continue exploring Governor Snyder's State of the State speech. We've heard from the governor. We've heard from Democrat Tim Grammel. Now let's get some perspective from Rick Pluta, Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing Bureau Chief, and Michigan State University Economics Professor Charlie Ballard. Rick, let's start with you. Just how would you rate the governor's message in terms of content and also the terms of likelihood of getting those initiatives through the legislature?
It was a pretty standard State of the State speech, a laundry list of things that the governor wants to see done in 2013, preceded by a bit of bragging about successes and progress made in 2012. The one wrinkle in that was just for one brief moment, the governor did allude to the controversies of last year and said that he was hoping that in 2013, he said he didn't want them. It was unfortunate that it happened, but that he's hoping that going forward they could find ways to work together. Probably worth mentioning that the Republicans who won all those fights stood up and cheered, and the Democrats who lost all those fights sat through that part of it. The prospects for getting them through, well, a lot of the things that he asked for were things that he also wanted done in 2012 that didn't get done, and I don't think that they're going to be any less controversial in 2013.
Turning to you, Charlie, is the Governor's Road Initiative good economic strategy for Michigan?
Oh, absolutely. I've said for a long time that letting our roads turn to gravel is a lousy strategy for economic development. In many parts of the state, we have some of the worst roads of the country. There are parts of the state that have pretty good roads, but many of our most heavily traveled roads are in bad shape. And given that trucks and cars are still king in terms of transportation in our economy, that's a handicap for our state going forward. We have manufacturers who sometimes have experienced having their products get destroyed or damaged in transit. We have ordinary folks like me who are bouncing on some of these roads. It's hard on the back. I guess maybe it's good for chiropractors. We do need to improve our transportation infrastructure, and I think that the governor is exactly right, that this is the kind of thing that if we continue to put off these investments, they will cost us more down the road, because the nature of road deterioration is that often if you repair it early enough, it'll cost you $1 million. If you let it wait and really crumble, it might cost you $5 million later to fix the same piece of road.
But here's the rub, then. How to pay for these repairs. Your thoughts, Charlie?
Well, one thing that I was surprised that the governor didn't mention, but maybe I can understand it in terms of the difficult politics, the money that we do spend, we don't spend terribly wisely. We spend more disproportionately a lot in rural areas and not as much in the urban areas where most of the people and most of the travel happens. But of course, if you were to try to reallocate the existing funds, that would cause a storm of protest from the rural folks who are very important in the Republican Party. So he called mostly for additional spending, and then you got to pay for it somehow. Well, honestly, there are lots of places that the money can come from. Higher gasoline taxes and higher registration fees are one. I don't think we should restrict ourselves to looking at those. If it were up to me, this would be a golden opportunity to revisit using the sales tax and reforming the sales tax to come up with additional funds. We could look to the income tax. Of course, I understand that that's extremely unlikely. My view is that it's less important where the money comes from than that we fix the roads.
I want to turn to the state budget, guys. The governor last night was trumpeting the fact the so-called rainy day fund has $500 million in it. Charlie, put that into context. Is that really all that much money compared with the entire budget?
It's a whole lot more than we used to have. We raided the rainy day fund in the last decade or so. It's not huge. The total amount of money spent by the state of Michigan is more than $40 billion, although about half of that comes from the federal government with strings attached. So the stuff that we raise on our own account is about $20 billion. So $500 million? Well, that's, let's see, do the math. That's 2.5% of the total that we have control over ourselves. So is that big? Is it little? It means that if the economy were to enter a downturn, we would have a little bit of a cushion, but it wouldn't be sufficient to see us through the kind of downturn that we had in the last decade. Let's hope that that doesn't happen.
Rick, a real theme of this speech last night seemed to be the governor saying that he wants to keep working on issues that were focused on in 2012, Blue Cross Blue Shield reform, Education Achievement Authority. What do you take away from that sense that for him, he really is still working from last year's playbook?
Well, now, I would put Blue Cross Blue Shield into kind of a separate category because it seemed like there was finally buy-in to get that done, and the legislature at the last minute decided to induct the abortion controversy into it by putting in some language that would require people to buy separate riders for elective abortions. And so that's kind of what torpedoed that. And so I wonder if that's really going to be that difficult to get through in 2013. The issues that we saw problems with in 2012, you know, in the case of the statewide education authority, for example, or anything to do with school choice, is, you know, we frame so many issues as being differences between Republicans and Democrats. And that's not necessarily an R versus D controversy, that Republicans that come from places where schools are doing pretty well, or at least their constituents believe their schools are doing pretty well, are pretty reluctant to do things that will upset the apple cart. You know, I don't think that dynamic has changed somehow since December of last year and January of this year.
In the last minute we have here, just real quick, for either one of you, what surprised you that you didn't hear from the governor last night? Were you expecting, or do you think we should have heard some things? I'll start with you, Charlie.
The governor mentioned briefly early childhood education. I'm very glad that he mentioned it. I wish he had said a lot more about it, because there's no investment that we can make in our future that will earn a higher rate of return. And if you're a state that now has fallen to 36th in per capita income among the 50 states, we should be looking for the things that will push us up the income ladder. And a more highly educated and more highly skilled workforce is far, far more important than anything else. And the biggest part of that is starting early with early childhood. So I was glad that the governor mentioned it. He didn't give a whole lot of specifics. I think that if we really want to be successful, that deserves a lot more attention.
How about you, Rick?
Well, you know, not as much what he said or didn't say, but I was kind of intrigued going into it. I was wondering what mention he was going to make of the big divisive battles of 2012 that he said that he wanted to avoid. And he didn't lead with it. He didn't close with it. He sort of mentioned it in the middle of the speech. And I wondered if he wasn't going to sort of address that 900-pound gorilla in the room at the outset. And he decided not to, that he would rather do what speechwriters call setting the table before confronting that.
Rick Pluta, Michigan Public Radio Lansing Bureau Chief, and Michigan State Economics Professor Charlie Ballard, both joining us from East Lansing. Thanks so much, guys.
Oh, thank you, Cindy.
My pleasure.
President Obama will be sworn in publicly for his second term on Monday. Michigan musician and storyteller Allison Downey recalls the president's first inauguration.
A couple of weeks ago, my 4-year-old son raced laps around the National Christmas Tree, admiring the model trains on display during our visit to my hometown of Washington, D.C. He stops in his tracks and points at, "The White House, Mama!" When I ask if he knows who lives there, "President Obama, Mama." And it occurs to me that he knows no other president. He looks at a picture of Barack Obama, and that is what the word president looks like. To him, it is normal that our president is African American, not noteworthy. A few blocks away, bleachers are being raised on Pennsylvania Avenue, and I'm wondering what's going on when, oh yeah, the inauguration's coming up, I forgot. It seems like no big deal this time. Every media source from the Huffington Post to the Daily Mail has articles bemoaning the second inauguration as, well, boring. Titles like, "The Thrill Is Gone." And why? They say it's a second term, been there, done that, the economy, political squabbles, and the fact that the second inauguration is simply not as historic. Thrill is gone. The 2009 inauguration had the largest attendance at any event in Washington, D.C. history. Nearly 2 million people. And I know that it's only a little more than half the country that's celebrating a political victory, and a little less than half that's not so thrilled. But last time, even my friends and family who were still grieving the loss of their candidate could still recognize and celebrate the historic importance of the first African-American president. Last time was different. And it was history. Not politics that compelled my husband John and I to fly from Michigan to stand in below 20-degree weather for 7 hours with our 4-month-old baby, to bear witness to the moment our country moved forward in our evolution of civil rights, for our son to be able to say that he was there, that this event is a line in his life story. But there were also these gut-wrenching fears that something bad might happen. And it didn't. Not a single incident of violence on the National Mall. Instead, something else happened. Something I wasn't prepared for. Optimism. It was palpable. I could taste it in the air. It brushed up against my skin. People glowed. Not in a radioactive sort of way, but as if we all belonged and were connected. Black, white, Asian, Hispanic, poor, rich, gay, straight, Democrat, Republican, standing in lines, perched in trees, sitting on shoulders, shivering on the ice of the reflecting pool, all to share in making history together. I held my baby tight to warm his face as I tried to nurse him without getting frostbite. In front of us, another nursed her infant. A gorgeous, multiracial woman had driven down from Brooklyn with her husband and infant for the same reasons. We bonded, huddled, shielding each other from the cold, protecting each other's modesty. And then, Aretha Franklin, in her impressive bow propped on a hat, wails, "My country, 'tis of thee," like the true gospel song it was meant to be. She lets loose on "Let Freedom Ring," and she means it. People all around me wailed along, black women in fur hats chanting back as if in church. This was a call and response. 50 years earlier, Martin Luther King had said the same words from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial facing the Capitol, and it feels like Aretha is singing them right back to him. Barack Obama takes the stage for the oath of office.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
Silence. Until we hear the words, "Congratulations, Mr. President."
Congratulations, Mr. President.
The crowd erupts, explodes. But the circle of black women in hats who danced and sang along with Aretha quietly bow their heads, lift their hands, and pray, while tears stream down their faces. Strangers hug strangers. It's as if we were dancing on top of the Berlin Wall. It was that kind of day. But we were all Americans, and there was optimism, goodwill, and kindness. And it carried into the night at Michigan's inaugural ball at the National Museum of American History. John and I danced in front of the actual Woolworth's counter that started the sit-in movement in 1960. The same one I'd been teaching about for more years than I'll admit. Here we were, celebrating the first African-American president. Next to the counter were 60 years earlier, black men and women the same age as the college students I teach, courageously sat down for their rights. So that today, sitting in restaurants that serve people of all races is normal, not noteworthy. So that today, schooling in a multiracial classroom is normal, not noteworthy. And today, for the 2013 inauguration, we're not talking about the first African-American president anymore. We're talking about the president. And it makes me wonder, what will be normal 20 years from now? A female president? An openly gay president? We'll know we've really changed when to children it's normal, not noteworthy. But for now, we have a boring inauguration coming up. Nothing groundbreaking. It's just normal. And then it hits me. Normal is what we're seeking. Our country is used to the peaceful transition and confirmation of power without incident. We respect the process, even if we voted for the other guy. People in Syria and Egypt and all over the world are laying down their lives now for what is normal to us. Our struggle took place hundreds of years ago, so that today, a peaceful inauguration is so normal, we forget how extraordinary it is. Yeah, I know, the groundbreaking is sexy, but normal is where it's at. So let's just celebrate how blessed we are to have a boring inauguration.
Allison Downey is a musician, a storyteller, and an associate professor at Western Michigan University. Views expressed by Downey are her own and do not necessarily reflect those of Michigan Radio, its management, or the station licensee, the University of Michigan. As we wrap up this week on Stateside, we want to issue an invitation to get in touch with us. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Head to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. We'd love your comments, story suggestions. Let us know of someone you think that we should profile here on Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again Monday at 3:00.